This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Good morning. Welcome to Emerging Trends, a monthly conversation with interesting, provocative people who have a direct connection with UC San Diego Extension's courses and certificate programs. I'm John Freeman, Communications Director at Extension, and today I'm very pleased to welcome Caitlin Rother, a best-selling true crime author who's based here in San Diego. Caitlin, thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me this morning.
It's my pleasure. Just a few words on Caitlin before we get into a conversation. Caitlin has taught her writing narrative nonfiction course for the past several years, and her upcoming 9-week course begins June 17th.
July.
We'll make that July 17th. I'm looking forward to what I'm sure will be a very stimulating conversation with Caitlin. She has much to offer. First, let me tell you a little bit about her. Here in San Diego, she's probably best known for the book Lost Girls, published in 2012, and it told the gruesome story of convicted killer and sexual predator John Gardner. The book proved to be a New York Times bestseller and caused much controversy for delving into the killer's motivation for murdering San Diego teenagers Chelsea King and Amber Dubois. Some observers thought writing such a book was, well, disrespectful. We'll discuss how today's guest reflects on her role in that controversy and, of course, the challenges of writing about such real-life tragedies. So let's get started. And my first question is, and it's somewhat irreverent, but Caitlin, why do you write about such awful stories?
Well, I feel that just like with journalism, I went into newspapers and journalism with the ideal that I could do something to change things, that I could help educate people and help improve our life. In this case, the reason I decided to write Lost Girls, we can apply it directly to that, mm-hmm. I felt this was an opportunity to educate people about sexual predators. I didn't know very much about sexual predators. I think it's, for most people, a pretty repulsive idea. They mm-hmm. don't really want to know. But the problem is, girls like Chelsea King and Amber Dubois are going to continue to get kidnapped and murdered and raped if we don't start looking at what we're doing wrong to allow this to happen. There are flaws in our system, and some of those were uncovered in the newspaper. I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to explore these flaws and really find out what, if anything, was being done to correct them, and also to help people protect themselves when they run into someone like this. Because I can tell you, I sat, you know, 6 feet away from John Gardner at Corcoran State Prison in the lunchroom, where it's just a visiting room, and Charlie Manson gets to see his family and friends there, just like John Gardner, sometimes on the same day. And I was so close to him, and I felt scared to go do this in case he grabbed me around the neck. Mm. But my point is, he was very friendly and very charming, and he appeared to be very non-threatening. So if you had met him in any other situation, you would not have known he was capable of doing the things that he did. And that's one of the things I want to try to educate people about in the books that I write, is sometimes people are not what they appear. And there are clues, and there are things that they say, there are the ways that they act. You can learn from reading my books to understand why people do the things they do and how to protect yourself.
This case caused much controversy, as I say. And I hope that I have this right. The families of Amber and Chelsea were upset that you wrote the book, mm-hmm. that the book got published, that you spent time uncovering the story behind the murders. I guess they wanted to, that they would prefer that this story not be told in book form because I guess of its salacious nature and because it was so personal. How do you reflect on your role in, I suppose, in bringing this whole episode to the surface again, and it hurt people that were very close to those girls. How do you reflect on that?
Of course, it was never my intention to hurt mm-hmm. anyone. I was trying to do something positive, as I just explained, to educate the public on sexual predators. And this case in particular is almost a primer on how a sexual predator is made and is born, and what to look out for, and how he acted, what he was thinking, and how he got himself into a situation where he was able to find these vulnerable girls alone and grab them. So I think everyone can learn from this, and I think it's I'm really sorry that those parents were hurt. I made every effort, mm-hmm. really, in this case in particular, to try to get their cooperation and their participation, and I was never even able to get to speak personally with the Kings. I tried because I wanted to be able to present my case, because I have not had this kind of problem with other books. I've always approached the victims' families. I've always been as sensitive and respectful as I can be, and I have some of the best, best relationships with some of the victims' families from my other books. So it saddened me and disappointed mm-hmm, me mm-hmm. that they came out afterwards as though I had never even tried, and that's simply not the case. Mm-hmm. So, and I've kind of lost part of your question, but I really, I'm really sorry that they were hurt. I knew that they were grieving, and the way that I approached it was, it's their grieving process, and I'm really sorry that they were upset by this, but I do feel like I was able to do some positive things, and if the people who were so upset about this book, who never met me, never actually looked or read the book, mm-hmm. Never gave the book a chance. They were upset by the idea of the book, not by the book itself.
Mm-hmm. Has the experience changed you in any way, or changed how you approach your job, your profession, your passion really is writing books about these, these true crimes, and that they actually happen? You're not making this up.
No. Well, and the other thing I wanted to say is, I think they thought that this was their story to tell, and what I felt, I went through this just like the rest of the community did. This was the community's story, and the community was really upset by what happened to those girls, and there were many people in the community who thanked me for writing this book, because mm-hmm. they said, we need to know about this. We can't just stick our heads in the sand. We need to know what we can do, and why didn't the police, go after him the first time after he attacked Candace Moncayo, mm-hmm. On the trail. Why did they not investigate that as an attempted rape? Why did they investigate that as a robbery? People were angry. And I think that, it's something helpful to shine a light, to make the law enforcement, talk about why they did what they did. But they did an excellent job with the Chelsea King case. Mm-hmm. The law enforcement acted quickly, swiftly, and very aggressively. And I was amazed at what a great job they did.
I'm thinking now of In Cold Blood, Truman Capote's, mm-hmm. Everlasting book about tragedy and how it affects an area and a people. Do you have an obligation not to tell such stories at all? Do you feel stories should not be told, or is it your role to tell these stories, to tell the inside, the real true crime story? I mean, This is what you do for a living. I think personally it provides a service. But is there any doubt that you have in your mind about your role in these things?
Well, one thing I did learn was that in San Diego, where I live, it's difficult to write a story that's so emotional. But I mean, that was part of the reason I chose the story,
yes.
And I knew I was going to get some blowback. It's difficult for me living here, though, to have to deal with that. If I were to pick a case like that anywhere else in the country, mm-hmm. and I was told this by other people, they wouldn't have reacted that way, mm-hmm. partly because San Diego is what San Diego is, and the way it is. But the fact is that, it's difficult to live in the same place and do that. But I don't think there's any story that shouldn't be told, but you do have to think about what people really want to read. And what kinds of stories you or I as an author want to spend time digging into. So I'll give you an example. People kept asking me, what about the case of Westerfield.
David Westerfield, yeah.
Why didn't you write that book? And I said, well, because I don't think people want to read about child molesters killing children. Mm-hmm. And I think with Lost Girls, you know, they were teenagers. They weren't they weren't 7-year-old girls. And that was a tricky line to walk. So mm-hmm. I didn't go into anything at all about what he did to those girls. I mean, I just didn't think that that was something that I wanted to read. I didn't think anyone else wanted to read it. I didn't think anyone needed to read it.
And sounds like you didn't want to write it either.
And I didn't want to write it. Yeah. And to be honest, John Gardner actually said to me he didn't want to talk about it. He felt that that was disrespectful, believe it or not.
Goodness.
He said that. So I think there are certain details that you can leave out, but the story overall, no. But except for something like David Westerfield, where I don't think anyone really wants to read that story. So it's not like I feel an obligation not to tell it. I just don't think anyone would want to read it. I wouldn't want to write it.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking with Caitlin Rother. She is an instructor at UC San Diego Extension. And since we're talking somewhat about the writing process, tell me about, just in kind of hard facts, do you write every day? How much do you write every day? Do you think about how much planning goes into before you start a book? What's your process?
Well, it kind of varies with each book depending on how I found out about when I found out about it. Because just for an example, I'm working on a case right now in Prescott, Arizona, the Steve DeMocker case. One of the readers I had from another book loved my book and started sending me story ideas. How about this? Would this be a good book? And one of them I said, well, go ahead, send me some stories. So she sent me some actual news clippings out of the newspaper. I didn't have time to read them. And when I finally did, the trial was almost over. I said, wow, this actually is pretty interesting. I dug in and I went onto the website of the local newspaper and I read 5 years worth of news stories. And I said, I definitely think this is a worthwhile story. I pitched it to my editor and I convinced her, but I had already missed the trial. So in that case, I have a lot of research to do and I can't observe the trial. I don't have notes from the trial. So that process is going to be different from another book that I had written, actually the one that she'd read, Dead Reckoning, where I spent 5 years going to 3 trials up in Orange County, back and forth, 2 hours each way. Huge amount of time gathering observations, and I had to cut, 35,000 words after I wrote that book, because I had like 200 more pages worth of information. So it just depends on when I come in and what I already have, who I have access to, and what research materials I have access to. I always go in once the sentencing is over and get all the exhibits that I can, all the discovery that I can. I bring my copy machine to the courthouse and I literally throw stuff in there for a couple days.
Now, when you're sitting down at your computer, does the writing flow easily? Are you as we say a bleeder, that every word is a drop of blood, or does it flow so easily that you get immersed totally in what you're doing?
I have to be really careful about writing long. I've been that way ever since I was a reporter, so I'm like an editor's nightmare. But I have to edit myself most of the time with this particular publisher. So I have more material than less, and I write a lot. I mean, it's easy for me, but I have to wait until I feel authoritative enough. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about narrative nonfiction. You're recreating scenes, so they read like a novel, but they're all true. In order to do that, you've got to do 4 times the amount of research than you would, say, for just a plain news story where you say, he said this, she said that. In narrative nonfiction, you weave together what you get from interviews, what you see for yourself, what you observe, what you can get from photos, what you can get from visiting someplace, what you can get from the investigators' interviews, what you get from the evidence that they found. You read reports, you read transcripts. I mean, you have tons of information. And before I start writing, I have to put all that into my head and weave a narrative that sometimes comes from one particular perspective, one person I interviewed, and oftentimes it's my perspective after gathering all that information, weaving it together, and spinning it out, mm-hmm. essentially.
So this process of weaving, mm-hmm. which ends up being the written word, can that be learned, and can it be taught?
Well, that's what I'm teaching.
I guess is the question.
That's what my class is
so
all about.
So what do you hope, when you start a class, what do you hope to gain, what do you hope your students learn? What's the end result?
Well, basically, I break it down And I teach them fiction writing techniques mm-hmm. and research and interviewing techniques, and I have to cram that all into 9 weeks, mm-hmm. 27 hours. And I have them basically come up with an idea, and I have them write about a 1,500-word scene, because the basic building block of narrative nonfiction is the scene. It's like a scene as in, you know, in the movies. You mm-hmm. have a beginning and a middle and an end. You have a climax and a resolution. And, you know, a number of scenes make up a chapter. A number of chapters make up a book. And I help them understand what a story arc is so that they're building to something. And help them, I put bullet points up. So here's how you can get your pacing. And here's how, you don't have too much for one scene. And it has to start and end within, a shorter time period. I have to help them kind of understand how to write a scene. And then once they get all that, sometimes I teach an advanced class where they can actually write more than one scene in a story. And then from there, they can go on to writing a book. But mm-hmm. that's the essential building block, is the scene. It's got characters, it's got the story arc, it's got description, it's got a setting, it's got, you've got to have a mood and the tone and understand point of view and the voice of the narrator. And so I give them different exercises, and we discuss this a lot, and do trigger exercises and help them develop just one scene so that they get the idea.
Mm-hmm. So are you a tough editor on your students? Are you encouraging? What's the style you have as an instructor, you think?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because, and I've had students tell me, I've had other teachers and they just say everything I do is great and you're not like that, and I really am appreciative that you're not like that. Uh-huh. Yeah, that you're really, you're tough, and I put a lot of red pen all over their papers, but it's to help them see what they're doing wrong and to ask them questions and to point them in the right direction to fix it and make it better.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about before you became a crime author. Tell me about your career at the Union Tribune newspaper and how that shaped your current career. What did you do there at the paper?
Well, I was an investigative reporter. I covered a lot of politics and government. And I kind of went back and forth between politics and government and, more human interest stories. Mm-hmm. So I actually developed a specialty while I was there about covering bizarre deaths. So if there was an editor...
Imagine that.
Yeah, an editor would come over to me and say, I think this is one of yours. And he or she would give me like a brief that had run in the paper about someone who had died. And I would go in there and turn it into a narrative story. So I had been working on a novel for years at home on weekends. And so I already had learned the fiction telling techniques. I worked with the writing coach, who later became my editor, Susan White, who I'm still friends with today. And she has gone on to edit 3 Pulitzer Prize-winning stories in 3 different times. Mm-hmm. I mean, not 3 stories, but 3 separate prizes. And so I learned from one of the best, and I started writing narrative in the newspaper. So then I was able to go from writing narrative in the newspaper to writing narrative in book length. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel at all constrained writing for a daily newspaper?
Yeah,
and now you have the freedom to write whatever you want, when you want, how you want.
Well, I can't write whatever I want, whenever I want, because you have to kind of think about the market and trying to earn a living. But I did feel constrained in that I didn't feel like the newspaper really, there wasn't enough room to tell a story anymore. Everything was shorter. And I just, I wanted to really dig into a story. And so that's what I really like about what I do now, is I can dig into a story for 9 months or a year or longer. It just costs me more money the longer I take to do it. Mm-hmm. But I have standards that I learned, unfortunately, when I was getting a paycheck every week I can't unlearn.
These are high standards.
They're very high standards. Yes. And I've had people tell me, lower your standards. I said, I can't. I don't know how. So.
Well, let's do this. I'd like to have you, if you would, read an excerpt from Lost Girls.
Okay.
And it, as it appears here, it'll be the first words of the book, the first chapter.
Right.
So tell us a story.
Okay. The book opens with John Gardner's, I just want to preface this just for a minute. The book opens with John Gardner's mother looking for him, and I just wanted to say the reason I wrote this book was, one of the reasons, was because I felt like I could really fill in a lot of the of the story that never got into the newspaper. John Garner's mother never talked to any reporters ever, and one of the biggest questions that people had was, what did she know? Did she help him? Did she not turn? Why didn't she turn him into police?
And as I recall, she was a child psychologist?
No, she was a psychiatric nurse.
Psychiatric nurse, right.
And so, you know, people blamed her. And
yes.
So I wanted to hear her story. I thought people wanted to hear her story. So that's why I started the book with her. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
John Gardner's mother was worried. The bipolar mood swings, erratic behavior, and suicidal impulses that had periodically plagued her 30-year-old son since he was a child were not only back, but worse than she'd ever seen them. When Kathy Osborne left her condo for her psychiatric nursing job the morning of February 25th, 2010, John was asleep on the futon in her home office, where he stayed when he visited. Kathy called his cell phone and texted him numerous times throughout the day to see how he was doing, but she got no response. When he didn't answer the phone, something was usually up. That evening after work, John was still missing in action, so she decided to combine her usual run with a search for her wayward son, an unemployed electrician and unmarried father of twin sons. Having completed 15 full marathons as well as 15 half marathons, Kathy routinely jogged 5 to 7 miles around Lake Hodges in nearby Rancho Bernardo Community Park. But she was so worried about John and his well-being that she didn't really feel like doing the full route. She jogged about a mile through the neighborhood, turned at the white railing off DeWenda Road, and started down the narrow path that widened as it left the residential area and fed into the vast, beautiful open space of the San Dieguito River Valley. Depending on the time of day, sometimes she couldn't see another soul for miles in any direction. It was so peaceful out there, far away from the stresses of the city, so isolated, so still, and so deadly quiet. But her nerves were on edge that evening as she ran along the sandy trail at dusk. She jerked to an abrupt halt, startled to see a snake off to the right. Once she realized it had no head and posed no danger, she continued heading toward the slate blue of the lake up ahead, hoping to find John in one of his usual haunts. He told her that he liked to sit on the bench-like boulders that were positioned along the trails, posted with informational placards about the Kumeyaay Indians and the natural wildlife habitat. Knowing his two favorites overlooked a waterfall and the lake, she kept her eyes peeled for discarded beer cans and cigarette butts, but she saw no sign of him. "This is the wrong spot, or he's been here, and he's just not drinking beer or smoking cigarettes," she thought. So I'll stop there.
Wow. So I'd like to know, how do you feel when you read those words?
Actually, I've read them a lot of times, so it doesn't like strike me in any particular way emotionally, other than I kind of go over in my head that I walked the same walk that she did, and the images that I saw as I was putting that together come back to me.
Mm-hmm.
How frightened I felt when I walked through that area alone at the same time that Chelsea King ran through there, and I got the heck out of there because I got creeped out.
So
I got
tell me
that's what brings it back to me, and I
every time you read it.
Well, just now, for some reason. It's been a while since I've read it, and I was just kind of reliving my experience going there, and while I was there gathering those details, I was kind of felt like I was reliving what happened to Chelsea. I mean, I get very close to some of these stories. In the one I'm writing right now, I've never gotten this close, and it's just really getting deep, deep into me, which is unusual, actually.
Well, let's talk then about your, I guess, the book that came out in January.
Uh-huh.
And that's the one about the Newport Beach millionaire who was murdered, correct?
Right.
Tell me about that book.
Well, I like to describe it as The Real Housewives of Orange County Gone Bad.
Gone bad.
This woman, Nanette Johnston Packard, was a gold digger. Mm-hmm. And she was out looking for a sugar daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And she put an ad in the Singles. At the time, it was 1991 that she met him, Bill McLaughlin, in the Singles Connection. Mm-hmm. So this is before online dating. Yeah. Some people, were looking in the classifieds. This was an actual newspaper designed for this. And she advertised for wealthy men only, and it was, an inch or two long, and it said basically, "I'll take care of you if you take care of me." And what that means is, I'll take care of you sexually if you take care of me financially. Mm-hmm. Bill McLaughlin answered the ad. Mm-hmm. And 4 years later, he was dead. She had been having this affair with an NFL football player, wannabe, essentially. He'd played 5 games but wasn't able to really make it and didn't have any money. And he thought she was his girlfriend. And she never told him that she had been living with this guy and was engaged to this older, wealthy man. And she convinced the football player to kill the older man because she told him that he had tried to rape her with a gun. And
mm-hmm. Now, as I recall, this case stretched out over a number of years.
Yeah,
right?
It was a cold case.
So it happened in, what, 93?
94.
Uh-huh. But it was only
2011 and 12, she and her former lover were convicted.
Uh-huh.
So it took 15 years. They got a new investigator from the DA's office to relook at the evidence. They found some witnesses that had been overlooked the first time. The ballistics had improved. And they went back in and they were able to present a winning case to the two juries. Mm-hmm. So
when all this wraps up, so it's 2011 or so.
12.
And have you already done some research on this, or did you at that time say, okay, I really want to dive into it? And so from what, I guess, the timeline, here's a story I want to write about, a story worth telling. And does it take a year to write the manuscript? Does it take a year and a half? Does it take two? And what's the...
Like I said, it really varies from book to book and whether I go to the trials. In this case, I went to both trials.
Uh-huh.
So before I even pitched it to my editor. So
you knew this was a book to be.
I can usually tell. I had one book that I mentioned before. It took me 5 years. I took a big risk on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I went to all three trials. And I think I pitched it at the beginning of the first trial, because I have to have a conviction with this particular publisher. So by then I had two out of three convictions already. But if it's a death penalty case, I already knew this prosecutor, after going through these other trials. And as a matter of fact, it's the same prosecutor from that book to the one that we were just talking about with Nanette Johnston, Bill McLaughlin. He's great. And I had faith in him, and it was the same police department, Newport Beach, so I already knew them. And in fact, I found out about that case while I was researching the other case.
Mm-hmm.
So the detective was preparing the search warrants the day that I called him to talk to him for the other book, and he told me about this case. And so I immediately said, wow, that sounds like a good case, and I put dibs on it with my publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took another couple years before the first trial happened, another year for the second trial to happen, and then I had to follow it all the way through the sentencing before I get access to any of the materials. So it really depends.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to have several books going at once, because you can't control the court system. There's always lots of delays. Things never happen when you think they're going to. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like there's
a lot of juggling going
on. Inherent frustration.
Well, it's just a lot of juggling.
The actual writing of the book.
Yeah, and I don't start writing until I do research. So I generally, once I get a contract, I wait till I get a contract before I do any writing, and then I do research for and interviews and a lot of reading for at least a couple months before I write anything. Mm. I have to think about how I'm going to tell the story, but it really depends, like I said, on who I get access to. Are they going to do interviews with me or not?
Mm-hmm.
So with Lost Girls, I really tried and tried and tried to get those parents and to get friends of those girls to talk to me, but I couldn't. So it took a lot of time to try to find people who knew the story well mm-hmm. enough that I wanted to quote them. I ended up using what the parents said on TV. So I used their own words,
mm-hmm.
That stories that they'd already told. So you can't tell when you read the book that I didn't actually talk to them.
Mm-hmm. So looking back on your career, not that it's you have many more, I'm sure, projects coming. But what are you most proud of? What book, what scene, what character, what moment, what sticks in your mind?
I actually am most proud of Lost Girls.
Uh-huh.
I feel like it is my most important book.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe everything that I said, that I really was trying to do something positive, and I feel like I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. What? Well, let's see. I think we have a few more minutes here. When a book is published, what sense of pride do you take when you hold it in your hand and here's my book? Is it worth, I mean, it depends, I suppose, on the advance, but is it worth all the effort and the frustration and the heart, everything that you put into it? Is that the satisfaction? Is that the fulfillment that you get?
You know, for me, it was when I first started, but now, these books really don't pay much. Honestly, I can't make a living just writing books. Oh. I do coaching one-on-one with clients. Some of them are my former students.
I see.
People find me on Facebook. People email me all the time. Do you want to write a book with me, et cetera? I end up trying to help them write the book. And I teach, obviously, and I do public speaking. I do TV work also. But what I really am motivated by, honestly, is the feedback that I get from people who thank me for doing what I'm doing.
Ah.
And thank you so much for doing what you do. It's so important, and you're doing such a helpful and important thing to pay a tribute to these victims and to shine a light on aspects of these cases that never get into the courtroom. And I kind of have to live off that. I have to live off the appreciation and how much readers, it's totally different. I mean, I would get appreciation at the newspaper, but nothing like what I get now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it makes me feel really good. And I always say, I couldn't do it without you guys. I say that on Facebook all the time. I mean, I couldn't. It wouldn't be worth it to me. So it's really great to get good reader reviews and to really feel heartfelt. Mm-hmm. You know,
and you have
feedback.
Fans out there.
I actually do. It's really nice. It's a nice feeling.
Uh-huh. Well, terrific. Thank you for joining me today, Caitlin.
Thank you.
A fascinating look at
Good.
A writer's life, as expected.
Can I just say one more thing?
Of course.
You know, I'm actually teaching a journalism class in the fall. That's a new class with the new digital journalism certificate. I just wanted to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beginning news and feature writing class, and I just, in addition to narrative nonfiction, I used to teach journalism, but I stopped for a few years, and I'm going to be coming back in the fall.
Well, journalism has a place, and it's alive and well with people like yourself who like to dig a little deeper into these stories. So, for UC San Diego Extension's Emerging Trends, this is John Freeman. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Caitlin, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right.